Lecture 2. The 8th Century Renaissance.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. As we noted in our last lecture, the Dark Ages began in about 1150 BC with the end of the Bronze Age, and they stretched through to about 750, the so-called 8th Century Renaissance. In the first part of this lecture, I want to discuss some aspects of the Dark Ages that we actually know about. And then in the second part, I want to deal with the 8th century Renaissance and the start of the Archaic period proper. Now, the Dark Ages are called that because we don't know everything that happened in this time. And we cannot explain what caused some of the things that we do know about to happen. For example, as we said in the last lecture, we don't know exactly how monarchy in the Bronze Age ended and how aristocratic families took over political power. They did because they were exercising it in the Archaic period, but exactly how it happened, it's an unknown. The Dark Ages as a whole can be subdivided into three periods, thanks mainly to pottery styles. For the first 100 or so years, so from about 1150 to 1050 BC, we have what's called sub-Mycenaean pottery, which is of poor quality. The designs are usually horizontal lines, circles, and so on, drawn freehand, and they often simply duplicate styles and shapes of pottery that you find in the Bronze Age. This decline in the quality of pottery, as it's been called, perhaps indicates that this was a period when society was still in turmoil after the collapse of the Bronze Age monarchies and any invasions that would have caused all manner of disruptions to social life. It may also explain what seems to have been a sharp population decline across most of Greece, with some communities, some townships, being decimated or even abandoned. Perhaps the people fled before these invaders reached them. After a century or so, things begin to look up, and we move to the second period in the Dark Ages, from about 1050 to 900. In this period, we have a style of pottery called proto-geometric. It appears first in Attica and then elsewhere, and as I said, it lasts until about 900. The style is still abstract circles, half circles, lines, etc., but they're better drawn than on sub-Mycenaean pots, and there's a real attempt to achieve some symmetry on the pots. If you can imagine, for example, a pot and it has lines or squiggles or whatever drawn in the zone around it, now there's an attempt to make that zone equal on all sides of the pot rather than having one zone wider on one side of the pot than around the other side. So there's some attempt then to try and get things right. Now, this advance is because of a faster turning potter's wheel and using things like straight-edged implements to draw lines, things like rulers as we would use. Another characteristic of this period is a slow rise in population, perhaps as people began to move back to the areas from which their parents or even grandparents had fled or been expelled. This takes us to the third and final division in the Dark Ages, and that's the period from about 900 to 750 BC. In pottery, we have the development of the geometric style, with the additions of new shapes of pots, new designs like zigzags and triangles, which fill the entire area of the vase, not just part of it, called the zone. And we also have representations of living things, from birds to human figures. Now, these are very crudely drawn. They're akin to the matchstick-like figures of an L.S. Lowry painting. I have to mention someone from Northern England. But nevertheless, this is a real step forward from what's been going on before. Indeed, this later geometric pottery is on a cusp, if you like, between the Dark Ages and the 8th century Renaissance. Away from pottery, we also find gold and ivory carvings being made, which show further artistic advancement on the part of the craftsmen. They also show two other things: that the economy was taking off, otherwise people wouldn't be able to afford ivory and gold, and that precious metals were being imported again from other countries. So there's a flourishing going on. Society all of a sudden is developing, is becoming more prosperous. We're therefore reaching the end of the Dark Ages. And it's against this background that in about 750 BC or so, we have a burst of commercial contacts between the Greek mainland and other parts of the world, especially Egypt and Syria. And we also have the sending out of colonies all over the place. Now, all of this marks the end of the Dark Ages. And it's no stretch of the imagination that what follows their end is referred to as a Renaissance. The term is deliberately chosen because it really was a rebirth. Just like the Renaissance of 14th century Europe, which started in Italy with the humanist movement, you know, Petrarch and that gang, and was a clean break from the doom and gloom of the Black Death and the chaos from the collapse of the feudal system, so this 8th century Renaissance heralds a new dawn in Greek history and civilization. And so we move from the Dark Ages into history again. We move, therefore, from the first part into the second part of my lecture now, the 8th century Renaissance. Now, two major characteristics that really show this period is a clear break from the past are increased trade, especially with the West, and colonization. Virtually every Greek state sent out colonists to the Black Sea, the North Aegean, and the West, principally Sicily and South Italy. Probably colonization, come to think of it, was something the Greeks were forced into doing because of the growing population as people returned to the mainland, and as a result, the increasing infertile soil that became unable to support that growing population. Apart from a few areas of Greece, especially in the north, the soil of Greece was relatively infertile. It still is today. So a staple crop like corn could not be grown properly. The Athenians, for example, would always be dependent on imported corn from the Black Sea area to meet their needs. The Greeks as a whole knew nothing about fertilizing the soil. Well, they didn't have anything, or crop rotation as we do today. And so as the population increased, the land became unable to support that population. What to do? Well, one way to solve the land hunger problem was for a city to send out a colony. And in Greek, the word colony is apoikia, which means something like home away from home. An apoikia consisted of a bunch of citizens headed by a leader who was called the oikistes, a word that means a founder. And this bunch of people was sent out to an already determined place. It wasn't luck of the draw. They already knew where they were going. For this, in other words, for the colonizing venture, the city, which was called a metropolis, and it's usually at this point in my courses when I mention metropolis, half a dozen students say, oh, is this where Superman comes from? But that's where the word comes from, because polis means city and mater means mother. So the metropolis, the mother city, had to seek the approval of the Oracle of Apollo at Delphi before it could send out a colony. Consulting the oracle then shows us the integral role that religion played in all aspects of Greek daily life. And this is something that we'll return to time and time again as we track through our next lectures. Now, once the colony was established, it was autonomous. The people, the colonists that is, gave up their citizenship of the metropolis. And the only ties that they had to it were sentimental. Ties like language, religion, social customs. They also took with them fire from the metropolis to start the first fire in the new colony. So that was symbolic. But after that, the colony was on its own. Doubtless it imported goods and perhaps had things in its new area that its metropolis wanted. So this created a trade between the two places. Now, the earliest wave of colonies took place in the mid-8th century to Italy and the West. A second wave took place about a century later to the coast of the Hellespont, the modern Dardanelles, and the Black Sea. This first wave, the earliest one in about the mid-8th century, supports the idea that the Greeks were opening up or enhancing their trade routes to the West. The second wave, that's in about 650 BC, supports the idea that overpopulation was forcing Greeks to search for good farming land, because this was in abundance in the Hellespont and the Black Sea areas. And these areas also had abundant natural resources and even fishing. There were some Greek trading settlements, colonies is really the wrong word, that predate the mid-8th century. For example, the people of Euboea, and that's that long finger-like island off the eastern coast of central Greece. The Euboeans founded Almena in northern Syria to open up trade with Syria and Mesopotamia in 825 BC. And they followed this foundation with Pithecusae in southern Italy in about 800. But these early trading settlements are not colonies per se. These are merely settlements of citizens sent over there to help facilitate trade. And so it's the colonization movement that's really the turning point between the end of the Dark Ages and the start of the Archaic period. And I've got no doubt that these early colonies that were founded with a view to trade were influenced by the Euboeans. Because once Greeks saw the economic consequences that can result from trading settlements and then colonies, everybody wanted to jump on board. And some of the more famous places in the Mediterranean world were Greek colonies, places that we might not actually think could be Greek foundations. Syracuse in Sicily was founded by Corinth in 733 BC, and Byzantium, which became Constantinople and then Istanbul, was founded by Megara, which was a city on Attica's western border. Now, colonies continued to be founded even as late as the classical period. There were so many of them, hundreds of them, that Plato referred to Greeks round the shores of the Mediterranean as frogs around the pond. If you go down to a pond at evening time, all you hear is this chorus of frogs, and they're all gathered around the pond. To Plato, that's what the Mediterranean looked like, with the Greeks being the frogs and the Mediterranean being the pond. There were so many colonies, so many Greek settlements. And in South Italy, for example, there were so many Greek settlements there that the Greeks called the area Magna Graecia, Big Greece. That's similar to how we might talk about Chinatown or Greek town in some of our cities today. Aside from colonization and increased trade, there are also artistic, social, and cultural innovations that mark this period as a renaissance. For example, the Greek alphabet, which borrowed heavily from the Phoenician, as we know it, comes into being now. The first Olympic Games were held at Olympia, traditionally in 776. These were in honor of Zeus of Olympia, and they were Panhellenic, in other words, all Greek, in the sense of drawing competitors and spectators from all over Greece. In time, other Panhellenic or all Greek athletic competitions were held. There was one at Delphi in honor of Apollo, at Ismia, which was near Corinth, in honor of the god Poseidon, and at a place called Nemea in the Argolid region of the Peloponnese in honor of Zeus. Now, these four, Olympia, Delphi, Ismia, and Nemea, together form what's called the Olympic cycle, with the Olympics at Olympia, that is, being the first and most important in the cycle. So we have these four competitions held every year in a different place. And that's why the modern Olympics are held every 4 years, because they're modeled on the ancient Olympics at Olympia, which of course were held every 4 years. And it's just as well that the modern Olympics are every 4 years, because I couldn't handle all those many commercials on an annual basis. But that's just me. Cult centres begin to spring up all over the place as well during the 8th century Renaissance. including the oracle of Apollo at Delphi and of Zeus at Dodona. And these attract Greeks and non-Greeks too, for that matter, from all over the world to visit them. There are more advances in pottery designs, the late geometric pottery, for example, and we now start to get the introduction of group scenes and mythological scenes on pots. So this is a real artistic advancement. We also have the appearance of the first large or monumental temples, monumental in the sense that the ones before them were small. It wasn't, however, until the middle of the 7th century BC that we start to find marble and limestone being used in temple construction. Literature also flourishes, especially epic poetry. Now, Homer's poems, the Iliad and the Odyssey, about the fall of Troy to the Greeks, the wanderings of the Greek hero Odysseus back to his home, were sung by bards since the 12th century as part of an oral tradition. Note, by the way, that these were sung, not recited. There was also no single version of these stories. Oral poets knew the stories of the fall of Troy or Odysseus's return, and they used a number of mnemonic devices and stock phrases, formulas and things like that when singing them. Now, it's commonly accepted that in the second half of the 8th century, these poems were written down. But they'd still have differences in the various versions. The poet singing the Iliad in Asia Minor, modern Turkey, might have a different version of it from the poet singing on the Greek mainland. It wasn't until the mid-6th century BC that a uniform text for each one was established. And we'll see why and how in a few lectures' time. So it's easy to understand why the 8th century is called a Renaissance, as we pass into what is known as the archaic period of Greek history that lasts until 478. Yet if the archaic period is this time of innovation, and when history comes alive again, so to speak, why is it called archaic? Now, that's the question I asked at the end of our last lecture, and you've been very patient. I'm now going to answer it. Archaic is a word that we use today to mean old-fashioned and even obsolete. A manual typewriter or a gramophone or an LP record are archaic. But the answer is that the word archaic, like many of the words we use today, has changed its meaning over time. And we no longer use it in its literal sense. We've probably forgotten what it literally means anyway. Archaic comes from the Greek word arche, which means beginning, the start of something new. Hence, we use the term to describe pre-classical Greece because the archaic period is a new one after the murkiness of the Dark Ages. It's the new historical period. As well as all these great advances, the archaic period is unfortunately marred by increasing warfare between individual states and civil distress among the people that culminates in civil war. It's this background that shapes the major political and judicial advances, though, and that's what I need to turn to now. Now, so far, we've been talking about changes that affect the Greek world as a whole, you know, trade, colonies, introduction of the Greek alphabet as we know it. Now I want to focus on the mainland of Greece, because this is where our three themes, remember, democracy, law, and imperialism, this is where they come about, this is where they happen, this is where the action is. And here, on the mainland of Greece, that is, we can also see that significant changes have taken place. During the Bronze Age, as we talked about in our last lecture, the Greeks lived in small areas, each controlled by a palace centre headed by a king. That king was independent of the other rulers, and so were the communities. So each palace centre then was autonomous, and the kings were likewise independent. There was no super king. During the Dark Ages, the monarchy disappeared, as we mentioned last time, and power fell into the hands of a number of aristocratic families that are given the collective name of eupatridae. Now, this literally means well-born or those who come from a noble family. Eupatridae, pater means father, and the prefix you means well, good, noble, something like that. So those who were born from a noble father. Now, in some cities, such as Athens, a number of families were in power, and they married only within themselves so as to preserve that power, to preserve the exclusivity. You can't break into that closed shop. Now, we don't know exactly who these families were, in the sense that we don't have names for them. We do have the names of some families, like the Alcmaeonidae, but we don't know the names of all of the families. And that's why we tend to use this collective noun, the Eupatridae, to refer to the ruling families. We also don't know how they came to dominate political life. Perhaps they formed the king's advisory council, this thing called the boule, and they usurped power for themselves at the end of the Bronze Age. But what we can say is that throughout the Dark Ages and into the Archaic, Greece was controlled by a number of aristocratic families who thus exercised oligarchic power. Greece was an oligarchy then. Now, gradually, some of these communities in various parts of Greece amalgamated into larger ones. And when this amalgamation took place, one town in particular became the main one for that area. Now, this main town had a high citadel and was the chief market for its area. Hence, for example, Athens became the chief city in Attica because of its high fortified Acropolis and its market called the Agora. Remember the Bronze Age? Remember how important it was to build that palace on top of a hillside? The importance of a fortified citadel? That the palaces were also their economic areas? You can see the connections now. Now, this chief town became known as a polis. In the plural, it's polis, not polises. And the people who lived in its area also became its citizens. In other words, let's go back to Athens. When Athens became the polis of Attica, and Attica is an area of about, 900 square miles, those who lived in the city of Athens were Athenians, and those who lived all over Attica were also Athenians. And as I said, we can see the origins of the polis in the autonomous palace centres of the Bronze Age period, because each polis was also autonomous. Now, polis is a hard word to grapple with. It really is. It's usually translated as city-state, but it was more like a state than a city. In other words, it was a geographical area. Oh, look, there is the polis of Athens, for example, as you approached it. But it was also an entity, a political entity that was a state. Maybe it's akin to Vatican City today. The fact that it's a city-state tells us something immediately about the nature of the Greek polis. Each one was its own territory and governed itself, as well as the area in which it was located. Each had its own citizenship. And later on, each had its own laws and coinage. It was self-sufficient and it was fiercely independent. Today, we know Greece as one country, with the capital at Athens, and places like Thebes, Delphi, Olympia, etc., having their own city councils, but ultimately bound to the government in Athens. Now, it just wasn't like that in antiquity. Each of these places was the polis of its own area. And so travelling from, say, Athens to Corinth, or from Athens to Delphi, was like travelling today from one country to another, leaving aside the language differences. Now, the bulk of the Greeks lived in a polis system that I've just been describing. This is where a number of towns had one that was the chief one, the polis. The other towns in that area were just towns. But there were some Greeks who preferred to live in an area that didn't have this central polis. And this type of community, remember, that's of people who want to live in an area in which their towns are autonomous, but they didn't want to have this central polis. This community was called an ethnos. Gives us our word ethnic, an ethnos. And many states in the Peloponnese and some in central Greece, like Aetolia and Phocis, were ethne. It's the plural of ethnos. Now, those who lived in polis, that's the city-states, those who lived in polis thought that the Greeks who chose to live in ethne were inferior. And they thought this because they considered the polis was the best form of community. They couldn't understand why anyone didn't want to live in the polis system. So this degree then of snobbery, if you like, of feeling socially superior to other Greeks already. And as for monarchy, well, the Greeks as a whole looked down their noses at Macedonia in northern Greece, which was a monarchy. The Greeks thought that people who lived under a king were too stupid to govern themselves. Needless to say, this is a factor that has to come into how the later Macedonian kings deal with the Greeks, but we won't come on to that until towards the end of our course. However, the polis system had flaws to it, serious flaws to it, as we'll see in a moment. And so those who were living in that system ought not to have been casting stones. The reasons why the polis system developed as it did are not properly known. Most common explanations include racial differences, or the different characters of the Greeks, and even geographical features like rivers and mountain ranges, because these made travel difficult. Remember, there are no roads in those days, there are no tunnels through mountains. If you wanted to go from A to B, you walked. And if you didn't need to go from A to B, you didn't go. So that means that a polis on one side of a hill or mountain can grow up completely independent of a polis on the other side of the mountain. And the two population groups might never know each other. This system might sound great on the one hand, this emphasis on self-sufficiency, this emphasis on autonomy, which is at the heart of the polis system. But this independence, these characteristics led to a feeling of xenophobia developing among the Greeks for each other. While we might expect the Greeks to have this fear or dislike of foreigners, like the Persians, for example, to us it sounds most strange that they would harbour the same feelings for each other. Aren't they all from the same race? And as time wore on, as we'll see, polis would even wage wars on each other. And these wars range from skirmishes over territorial disputes, for example, to states actually taking part in massive civil wars that would rip Greece apart, like the Peloponnesian War of 431 to 404. It's the polis system that explains why the Greeks were only able to unite a couple of times. The first during the Olympic Truce, as it was called, and the second time when faced by a common foe, like the Persians in the early 5th century. It also explains why a king like Philip II of Macedonia in the late 4th century could so easily defeat the Greeks by playing on their disunity. Now, the Eupatridae, these aristocratic rulers, were not very good rulers, and a huge gap soon arose between the aristocrats and the non-nobles. Social and economic distress was rampant throughout Greece. Many people started to starve. Not everybody could take part in a colonizing venture or wanted to. So what we have is the Eupatridae starting to focus only on themselves and on faction fighting among themselves and ignoring the plight of the poor, the non-nobles. And during the Dark Ages and even after the Dark Ages, there were a series of natural disasters, bad harvests, probably a rise in birth rate. And as a result, the land would just not support the ordinary farmers. And so they took out loans from their rich aristocratic neighbours. And they became known as hektaimeroi, from the Greek word hektaimorion, which means one-sixth, meaning that they probably had to pay back what they borrowed together with one-sixth of what it was in the form of interest. And if they defaulted on this repayment, then their lands were seized. And this happened throughout Attica. And then to make matters even worse, they could be sold as slaves by the aristocrats to try to recoup their losses. Now, this is not only a terrible situation morally, but it's also a breeding ground for civil war. Imagine being sold into slavery by your peers, by your fellows. And so we move then to the scenario of where we start to see social and economic distress leading to the overthrow of existing regimes, the onslaught of civil war. And that's where we're going to be picking up next time, with some states outside Athens who experience this civil strife that leads to new regimes. Thank you very much.